Check podcasts.
The Center for Ocean Applied Sustainable Technologies, or COAST, welcomes you to COAST Talks, showcasing the people, ideas, businesses, and communities driving innovation in Pacific Canada's sustainable blue economy. Brought to you by the South Island Prosperity Partnership.
Welcome to the COAST Talks podcast, a deep dive into the innovations driving BC's blue economy. My name is Jason Goldsworthy and I'm the Executive Director of COAST, the Centre for Ocean Applied Sustainable Technologies. I'm sitting in Victoria, which is the land of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples, today known as Songhees and Esquimalt First Nations. Before we get started on our podcast today, I'll just talk a little bit about COAST. COAST is an initiative of the South Island Prosperity Partnership and we are Pacific Canada's hub for the blue economy. We're here to support our members' research, start up and scale sustainable ocean innovation. On today's episode, we're joined by Marine Labs, a pioneering company leading the charge in transforming maritime decision-making through its data-driven coastal intelligence platform, CoastAware. To talk about Marine Labs, we're very privileged to have Scott Beattie, the CEO of Marine Labs, with us today. Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
Pretty well. Great to be here.
Thank you for your time. Going to jump straight in. There's some pretty exciting news that's just happened in the last week. Can you tell us a little bit about why Marine Labs is setting new messages or new trends?
Yeah, for sure. So first off, we're a maritime technology company based in Victoria, and we've been working on building technologies that help real-time decision-making for ports, vessel pilots, and also collecting data and making that useful for coastal engineering and climate resilience. And over the last little while, even in COVID, we were working on potential for raising funds and did a bit of pitching myself, learned a lot of things, and it kind of came to fruition last late summer where we were entertaining discussions with VCs. And so we've recently closed a seed round and we're super happy with the partners who've come on board. And so we were able to announce it just recently. And Minister Champagne from the federal government was willing to give us a comment on our press release. And we had a lot of great activity on social media and lots of different things going on. But really, the funding for us is going to be amazing in catalyzing new progress for us and in taking what we've built here in Victoria and applying in Canada, but taking it to other jurisdictions like United States and other places.
It's such a great story, which we're going to delve right into a little bit later. But I want to jump back almost to the start. So how did you get started in this business and this sector?
Yeah, I mean, you and I have a bit of history as well. We crossed paths at one point on this story, but I grew up on Vancouver Island and spent a lot of time on beaches and coastlines. And for me, I was into skimboarding and all these various, you know, swimming and boating and snorkeling. And so that really kind of set the tone for me. And I went in through mechanical engineering at University of British Columbia. And then ended up being interested in renewable energy, but in specific ocean renewable energy. And back then there was a formation of a small cluster growing and there were some ideas about ocean wave power, providing power to coastal communities along BC's coast. In that time, Ucluelet was a very interesting opportunity. And so I ended up getting in, starting with a technology company that was trying to develop an ocean wave energy converter and made some progress there and learned a lot about how startups operate and what being the first engineer in a startup looks like and, you know, some do's and don'ts potentially on how to, you know, interact with potential funders or customers or what have you, and just how to move technologies from a readiness level of proof of concept through into something that's a bit more proven that can maybe be investable. And so learned some great lessons there, but ended up getting into studying that same thing, but in graduate school at University of Victoria starting in 2006. So I'm now aging myself officially here and studied basically the best way or what are optimal ways to absorb wave power and convert it to electricity, and just loved it. I loved my time at University of Victoria, building prototypes, running numerical analysis, testing things in wave tanks, and met some great colleagues along the way and learned a ton about ocean technology and really what works and what doesn't work. And specifically learning how floating bodies move in relation and in response to weather, like wind and wave and currents, and how to understand that, and then maybe how to make that useful. And so as I finished my graduate studies and finished with a PhD at University of Victoria, I ended up consulting for a little while, and that's where we crossed paths. And was working on a couple of different projects, did some things for US DOE, and worked for a couple of companies as a consultant. And my co-founder at the time, we were consulting in different fields, and he was working on coastal engineering. And we found that there was this problem that kept coming up, which was there's a lack of availability of measurement data from coastlines. And all of these projects kind of needed more measurement data. From a coastal engineering perspective, it was, how do I validate this desktop model of what the waves and wind are going to do over the next, say, 10 to 100 years? But even for wave energy projects or for other types of activities on the coast, what's actually happening right now? And so there was this kind of genesis moment there where we realized that there's an opportunity here. There's not much on the market at that time that we could just go and buy and make work. So we decided, well, you know what? Let's give it a try. Let's build something. And so that's how Marine Labs started, and that's how I ended up here. And so we incorporated Marine Labs in 2017. So that gives you there's a bit of a history for you.
So it's actually a pretty, I mean, 2017 to 2024. You talked about, you know, closing a seed round. It's a pretty good timeline to move. So you've been moving pretty quick, getting that done. Can we talk a little bit more about the technology and how it collects data? And you mentioned at the start, you know, it's about real-time decision-making. What makes it different from some of the more traditional types of technologies that do data collection?
Yeah, for sure. I might actually, the last comment though, 7 years is for a technology company, say you're working on software and you're looking to raise venture capital. Often companies will raise a seed within a year and a half, maybe 2, maybe 3 years. So to me, it feels a little bit like a long time, but we were able to bootstrap to this point, which allows us to prove a lot more of what we're doing, which gave us a lot more strength in our pitch. And when we have hardware as part of our stack, of our technology stack, it's a lot different than selling a software product. And so there's a lot more risks that need to be mitigated in, and especially in the pitch, to show that you've mitigated all these technology risks. So 7 years is overnight. And you know, it depends what field you're in. But if you if you have hardware as part of your technology offering, that's a lot harder to raise money for. And so just kind of want to acknowledge that for all the companies that are out there developing, you know, physical things that have hardware.
It's actually a really good point. I mean, we talk about, you know, new technologies and people often think software, and it is. The pathway for a software company is a lot faster and a lot quicker. But hardware companies, you know, the proof of concept and the time it takes. So, yeah, the 7 years is quite quick for was very successful for what you've been able to achieve. But yeah, it's more a realistic approach, and not only for the companies that are going through that development, but also for the investors too, that, you know, don't expect returns straight away. You know, these are long time to pay back, but, you know, that's out there, and it's obvious your success has shown that it's doable.
Well, thank you for that. So the technology. So we have built a super rugged IoT or Internet of Things unit that is self-contained, and it measures directional wind, directional wave. It has cameras on it, and it can have other modules that we bolt onto it. And this thing is solar powered, and it can convert anything that's currently existing out in the ocean into a real-time data station. And so that may be a small floating buoy, but it could also be an existing navigational aid, like the red and green buoys that you would see boating along the coastline. And so the way I like to describe it is Canada has the longest coastline in the world, but only 41 government-owned ocean data acquisition buoys that provide data for marine safety. We also have around 5 to 10,000 floating navigational aids that could all be data stations. And so we've built a technology that in 15 minutes, when we go to a buoy, we can bolt it on to that navigational aid. And all of a sudden we have this data available for marine safety and for other different uses, like I talked about before. So that's a unique piece, is that we can bolt it on to anything. Another piece is that we're transmitting data a lot more frequently than typical technologies. So often over the last 15, 20 years, data systems from the ocean might be transmitting every half an hour or hour. We're up at the 15-minute level. We can make that even faster. Other kind of unique qualities are that we're sending super high resolution data directly to the cloud. So we're able to process it there on the cloud rather than on the unit itself, which means that we have all this opportunity to apply machine learning algorithms and computationally heavy analysis techniques. So that means the customer is getting insights rather than just raw data streams. So there's a lot more that we can do with the data by sending the super high resolution through our cloud system. So that's another kind of unique area, that, you know, approach that we have. Obviously, that changes when we're on satellite telemetry, and, you know, it's dependent on where we are. But we really are a coastal data company. That's really where we're our project and our product shines. And so the last piece is that, you know, it's kind of typical in the for, say, a coastal engineer or for a wave energy project or for even a port to have to go and figure out how to cobble together something that provides the data that they need. And that means that they might have to buy equipment and have a technician team that can then go deploy this equipment, and then they have to maintain it through warranties. Whatever happens to it, the weather is constantly trying to degrade in a road and move it off station, whatever happens. But that's not what they want to focus on. They want to focus on the movement of commerce. Like for a port, for example, they want ships to come in efficiently. They don't want to be buoy experts. And so that's where our business model is different, in the sense that ports come to us. We take care of everything from the deployment. We own and operate the hardware, and we just let them receive the data. We make sure that is as reliable of a data source as possible, so that they have this reliable, easy to use data stream that fits within their systems, and they don't have to be worried about any of that other stuff. So that's really the kind of core other bit that makes us unique. We don't sell widgets. We sell subscriptions to data.
So they're getting exactly what they need to make the decisions they need. So, as you said, you know, they don't have to bother themselves with being data experts or technicians for fitting this on. They buy the part, it's there, and they get the result exactly what they want.
Yeah.
It's a great, it's a great model in the end. Can you give some examples around why this sort of data is so important for marine safety in things like the ports or the coastal arrangements? So why is the weather data, what are they using that for? What are the customers, I mean, they're getting this data, but it's so important to their operations.
Yeah, so there's a few things going on right now in the ocean, right? And it's really quite an exciting time, because there's a lot of opportunity. So I think there's a lot more focus on supply chain. I mean, the supply chain crisis and COVID and the knock-on effects to the ports, and how many people know about ports and supply chain now that didn't pre-COVID. It was just sort of an invisible part of the global economy prior to that, prior to the Suez Canal blockage and the knock-on effects of COVID, right? But what's happening is that ports are roughly the same size. The navigation channels are the same size, but ships are getting larger, because the larger the ship, the more efficient the entire supply chain is. And so something has to change there. There can be a lot of land moved and dredging, and there's a fair amount of that, but also we can use data to help mitigate some of those risks. And so you're seeing ports make a move toward being smart ports, using a lot of sensors and a lot of digital twin and a lot of different types of techniques to try to improve the safety and operations, optimize operations. At the same time, we have weather volatility increasing. We have a sea level rise problem that's gradually, you know, folks say the standard is half a meter by 2050. We're seeing, continually seeing weather records. It's going to be interesting to see what truly does happen by 2050 compared to what has been predicted. And so I think that, you know, with the combination of increased weather volatility, bigger ships, ports staying the same size, the focus on supply chain being really important. There's a really important opportunity there to provide data to help that. So that's that kind of piece on how, you know, why and why now, effectively.
And you mentioned it earlier on about machine learning and artificial intelligence, if we want to get in there, but they do rely quite heavily on reliable, accurate data to trend. We won't get into the whole artificial intelligence machine learning topic today, but that's also bringing in another sector that, you know, the ability for those sorts of technologies to actually support smart ports or be better for forecasting what could happen in the future. And this data is obviously very critical to its success.
Yeah, absolutely. Forecasting is super important, and there's a global trend toward better and better forecasting, which is exciting. There's a limit there, obviously, but there's some really interesting new forecasting products coming along. But it turns out if you have measurement data exactly where you're trying to forecast, the exact point, then you have a very strong opportunity to have the best forecast possible. Because actual data combined with forecast technologies is really where the forecast becomes amazing. Yeah. So that's where we're targeting our efforts in weather intelligence and providing for not only the real-time data, but also the forecasting aspect. That's something that we can help ports. I mean, a use case, for example, is a harbor master, say Port of Halifax or Port of Prince Rupert, they might know that there's going to be a storm coming in and it could be, say, 40 knots winds. Well, if there's a ship that's trying to unload cargo during that time, often 40 knots is far too high. They actually have to stop the unloading operation and kick the ship out of the port and say, go out to sea, because that's where you need to be for this until the storm's over, and then we can finish that unloading. Well, if you can get more certain at whether or not that's going to happen, means all those cranes and all those people and all that risk that's endured by trying to get a ship in or out of a port is going to be, you're going to have a much better bet on what to make, on the move that you need to make. So that can be per ship. We're talking, I mean, outside of the safety aspect, even just the delay of a ship by an hour can be $50,000, $100,000 that's felt throughout the supply chain.
Yeah. And then the ongoing delays, and then it just ripple effect, right?
Like exactly.
We talked about with, you know, what challenges they've had with supply chain. How does the technology, and how do you as Marine Labs ensure the accuracy and the reliability of the data?
Yeah, it's something that we take super seriously. Our product and our approach to the market isn't to be the cheapest, the lowest cost. It's about being the most reliable and the most accurate. And so with accuracy, it's about constantly evolving the validation, the comparisons to other third-party data sources, like really doing well at the science part of it. And that's something we take pride in. And then on the reliability side, we're constantly measuring the uptime of our entire network, and we're comparing the uptime of our network and our measurement systems compared to the existing systems. So if we go into a port region, we're going to be taking the third-party buoy data, maybe that's a government-run buoy, maybe it's something else, and we're going to be running a comparison. And if that buoy drops off, say, for 2 or 3 months, we're still running. That's where we start showing that we have an advantage in terms of reliability. And that's happened multiple times over the time when we've been deployed outside of ports. So that's, you know, uptime is the sort of core company KPI, and everybody's moving to try to improve that. And that goes through the entire technology stack, from designing the equipment to have multiple redundancies in it, extra battery power, redundancies in terms of the sensors themselves. If there is, for some reason, cell network outages, we have redundant telemetry where we're sending a little bit of data through satellite so the customer can still get their data. So we view this a little bit like NASA might view designing a Mars rover, where you have multiple backups and redundancies. It's not quite that level, but you think about, you know, a widget that you might throw out in the ocean versus Mars rover, or a lot further toward Mars rover than you might think.
Yeah, I think we all know the marine and the ocean's a pretty harsh environment. It's probably even harsher than Mars in some respects. I mean, the amount of weathering that these technologies get, it makes it the challenge to keep them reliable. I want to talk a little bit about customers. So you mentioned ports. You know, one of your key customers. What do you see your customer profile looking like as you're growing as well? I mean, what does it change from ports? You talked about communities. How does that sort of work into your business strategy?
Yeah, great question. I think it's core to the reason why we've kind of gotten this far as a technology company. I think as a tech company, it's absolutely paramount to be able to stay focused. In the early days, you're going to get a customer that's way outside your sweet spot in terms of what you provide, and they're going to ask for something that's really weird. And if you keep saying yes to those, you actually won't be a company anymore, because you'll just break your technology, because it will never have a pattern that's common, and you can never have efficiencies in the development of that technology. So we've had to do a lot of saying no to weird requests, right? Or outside target requests, even though we really appreciate all of those and we're trying to, but we need to pick a path through the market and have a real business. So that's with that philosophy in mind, we have had to do some customer discovery and figure out who needs this data from the very beginning and test things out and try and realize, well, that's maybe not a market because it's not repeatable. And but it turns out that we found out about this ports piece and we gave it a real try, and we got great feedback immediately from the harbor master and from the vessel pilots. I'm not sure how many folks on the line here listening know about vessel pilots, but these are the people that have to go out in a boat, a smaller boat, and meet every single ship that comes into Canada and climb up a rope ladder in whatever weather, and then go and pilot that ship into the port, and then they do the same in reverse when they're taking the ship out. And so the data right at their pilot boarding station is absolutely important to them, because the vessels are trying to say, look, we need to get this product to market. There's a lot of vested interest here to get the product to market. Mm-hmm. And so to have a new data stream that allows them to say, nope, that's higher than the criteria than we're allowed to run this operation. I'm not climbing onto that rope ladder right now.
Yeah.
It literally saves lives. And in the case where the forecasts are wrong and they're saying, gale force wind or what have you, and then the data saying, it's not so bad, well, then that ship actually gets to come to port when it wouldn't have, right? So we've got on both sides this win that's happening with data. Yeah. So we got this feedback right away and realize, let's just stay focused on that. Let's try to replicate that in other areas. And also, there's this other market that's different to them, which is we've collected this data over long periods of time. There are folks that are trying to build coastal protection where they're building seawalls or breakwaters outside ports, and they need statistics and historical data in order to validate models to design these breakwaters. Mm. And so that historical data becomes a value to them. So those are the kind of two cases where we've just said, look, we're going to just follow that. We're going to keep doing that and see what kind of signal we get from the market. And it turns out that the signal is good. Now we have a lot of other opportunities, right? Wave energy projects, some surfers want access to it. Maybe they won't even pay us $10 because they borrow the Netflix account from their parents. Or sailors, recreational boaters. There's a lot of different markets, and there's many. But we've had, in order to kind of keep this focus that we need to keep this business running and to do a good job, we need to stay focused on those use cases. But I do see the use cases as we get repeatable with those first ones, we'll then have answers to those other requests as we move out into the use cases. So there are interesting applications in insurance, for example. When you start getting a coastline worth of data, you're going to have an opportunity to help insurers understand what their risks are in terms of coastal flood hazard. So this is something that's more interesting in the U.S., in the Gulf, and Eastern Seaboard, potentially. A little bit less in BC of a concern, some areas, but not as big of a concern. But around the world, it's a huge concern. Mm-hmm. And so it's and then there's interesting partnerships that are possible as well that come with this data set, that come with our ability to generate insights. So again, it's just all about being extremely careful for us on what we get into, because we want to do it really well and we want to make sure that it has a business model associated.
And you bring up partnerships. I want to talk about a couple of different areas. One is specifically on the technology side of it. You talked about a little bit about the type of data is collected: wind, wave, weather conditions. Do you ever incorporate that with other data sets from other systems to give a bit more, like for the end user, for more, I guess, additional data?
Yes. So the really neat thing about our model is that when we're sending all this high resolution data to our cloud, we can now combine it with other data sets. And so one example is we are around every single buoy monitoring AIS data from vessels. Mm-hmm. AIS is an automatic information system.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, just think of that.
And every large vessel has to have it by law, and it tells on VHF radio, and it overlays on different chart programs for all sort of industrial commercial mariners, the position and heading and who owns the vessel, how fast they're going. So this is a public data source, but it can also, there are third-party scrapers that collect this via satellite. And anyways, I'm getting into the weeds, but AIS data is an interesting data source. So it's who's around our buoys. And it turns out that there is a, for us, we found out a way to monitor and detect vessel wakes within our data. And so the combination of monitoring AIS data and detecting vessel wakes within our data allows us to generate these reports, that is, who's generating vessel wakes and how often, and how large are the wakes, how damaging might they be. And this is, you know, reports over years where we're measuring, say, tens of thousands of vessel wakes in and out of a harbor. So we can create reports like that. So that's one example. So there's that stuff that we love to do, is fuse or combine other data sources in with ours to provide an insight.
Well, that sort of leads me into where I was going for the next question about collaboration, is more on the community side, because, you know, you talked about vessel wakes and that leads into coastal protection and coastal awareness. With, as you're building this technology, how are you working with, you know, communities and how are you partnering with sort of the communities where this technology is deployed?
Yeah, we've had from 2019, a number of good relationships with communities. We did a really interesting project with Tsleil-Waututh Nation in Burrard Inlet, looking at vessel wakes. And that's where we sort of started the whole vessel wake project that we've been working on, and had a lot of success there, kind of showing what vessel wakes are available or what's happening and how Tsleil-Waututh might endeavor to make policies about how vessels traffic should go around that region. So we did that with a couple of different other groups as well. We've worked with Lake Cowichan Nation in the Gulf Islands, and we also have had a very long and successful project with Sauk Nation in Sauk, and that's just coming to a close now, where we worked with Chief Gordon Planis, former chief now, and him and his team have been amazing to work with over the last few years, and we were able to do some really interesting work there, including testing our own new technologies as they arise. So it was excellent. And a couple of things that were interesting there were the heat dome that happened. Mm-hmm. That was, I believe, 2 years ago, not last year. There was a big shellfish die-off event, and we measured the water temperature outside the basin, the Sauk Basin, as well as inside, and we were able to make comparisons to that during the heat dome and show the potential impact of the creek water heating the basin, which caused this over 20 degrees Celsius water in the basin during that heat dome. Just unbelievable. And so super interesting stuff there, but then also the vessel wake detection, really understanding how many vessels are coming in and out of the harbor there was very interesting. So we take it seriously to work with communities, especially First Nations, and we're super excited to work with them, moving forward. And it's a big part of our sort of company culture and the kind of things we like to work on.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We've got a few more minutes left, if you don't mind. I want to talk about, you mentioned really early on about, you know, almost support for other companies and advice. And you've been through this a couple of times, and you did date yourself earlier. you've got more hair than I do, but we don't see that on radio. What's kind of your advice? I mean, you've been through this process. You've now get it, you know, the success of the seed round, which is fantastic. There's been ups and downs, I'm sure. What's probably some of the key advice you'd have for people embarking on this journey in a new technology in the ocean sector?
That's a big one, but the first one I would say is focus. You know what I mentioned before. I think it's really easy to try to do 5 to 10 things at once, but it seems easy, but in the end, the quality of your execution matters a lot. Mm. And to pick something that you have, you know, a strong signal on that you think is a real market that's going to help people or help industry. I think to follow that through and learn the lesson of indeed, is that a market or not? It's mm-hmm. a lot better to go that way than it is to try and do 10 things all at once poorly. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing I'd say. Another thing would be, beware of hardware. It's quite challenging, although it's rewarding as well because you're interfacing with the physical world. So you have an opportunity to create something that is more unique potentially than what just a pure software play or a pure data science and software play might be.
Yeah.
So just be aware that the timelines are longer. Everything's stretched a little bit longer because there's a lot more potential risks there. But I still love it. And so you have to be up for the challenge, basically, but it's amazing. And other things, I think surround yourself in amazing mentors. You know, there's been an incredible group around me, including mm-hmm. those in Coast, mm-hmm. Including those in the university, including those in Viatech, and Foresight Clean Tech Accelerator, and other places that have just given us that right boost, that right piece of advice, that right support, the connection to somebody who has the skill that we need in our company that might even do that on a fractional basis, you know, instead of being a full employee. So be really open to mentorship would be the last thing I'd say there.
And your team is growing. How do you attract passionate people? How do you get people working for you that, you know, want, I mean, obviously there's a little bit of, you know, a calling, people want to make a difference. How have you found being able to attract those sorts of people?
It's a, you know, probably my biggest job right now. And I think my approach to it is to truly be authentic in the way that I speak in things like this, but elsewhere. And that means connecting to what I really love, which is spending time in the ocean. And so it turns out that, you know, folks that like that too align really well with Marine Labs. And so we're often looking for former sailors or current sailors or kayak or surfers or what have you, folks that really understand what weather looks like and happen to be able to communicate about it as well. And so, you know, the attraction is you know, just truly being authentic about what we love. And the fact that we've brought that to this company and the company ethos means that I think it just naturally attracts people. And trying to preserve that as we grow, that's going to be the most important thing moving forward here.
So, good segue. What's the next challenges and what does the next 5 years look like?
Next challenge is, we have some hiring to make. We mm-hmm. have open positions. Please go to our careers channel and check it out. And if and as the Coast ED, please forward them on for us.
Yes.
There is a lot of work that's going into the go-to-market strategy in the U.S. And so we're doing a lot of traveling and meeting with different potential customers and meeting with different potential partners. And there's a lot more technology to build. We've got just the start of this amazing weather intelligence solution, but it can be so much more than that. And as we export that around the world, we're going to have to cross all different kinds of technical challenges there. So we're excited to do that and continue building that. Next 5 years, I'd like to see us fully active in the U.S. market, being a real go-to for different ports that may be a little bit underserved potentially by the national weather services, by the, you know, the data that they're currently getting, vessel pilots as well. And I think there's a lot of really interesting coastal engineering work being done, including terminals that are going to be dealing with the new offshore wind industry in the US, which is exciting as well. So we'd love to take part in that. We think that there's a lot of opportunity there. And I could see us in places like Europe, Australia, New Zealand, different places that have culture that's quite similar to ours, which makes it easier for us to kind of communicate and understand, have a mutual understanding about the value proposition we bring.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's that a little bit general, but that's what I'd say.
Well, and you mentioned there's 4,000 or 5,000 navigational buoys on the Canadian coast. I mean, there's a good market as well. So we want to keep you here too while you develop that technology.
Exactly. And there's a lot more to do in Canada. And there's a lot of the blue economy that can be served by this type of service. And so we're keen. We're here and we're scalable and we're scaling and we're receiving investment in order to scale up. So we think it's going to make a big difference in marine safety in Canada.
Scott, it's one of the best stories. I mean, the news last week was fantastic. Congratulations. It's been, I know, a challenge, and we've known each other for nearly 10 years now, and there's always ups and downs, but I wish you the best, and we're here to support Marine Labs and celebrate that, you know, this is a technology developed right here in British Columbia and is going to make huge impacts to the world. So congratulations and thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And thanks to our listeners for joining us on Coast Talks. If you'd like to learn more about our work, visit our website at canadacoast.ca or follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Bye for now.